Get ready, get comfy for the next Nonprofit Insider Podcast episode.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome in, everyone, to another episode of the Nonprofit Insider Podcast, episode 48, and we are fully loaded today. I have a very special guest I'm going to introduce here in 60 seconds or less. But listen, before I get to this mega guest, from New Mexico to North Carolina, states with two names in their names, funny enough, be sure to follow the podcast. Listen, we're on TikTok. I know everyone's on TikTok. It kind of sounds cheesy, but listen, there's some good videos out there. So we're on TikTok. You can follow us on Instagram. Be sure to subscribe. And listen, do me a favor. It's summer. It's hot. It's so hot. And if you are a fan of the podcast, the only thing I need you to do is leave a review, 5 stars. You can go on Apple Podcasts. Of course, you can go on Spotify. You can leave a review, say all the amazing things you love about being an insider, because we love our insiders here at the Nonprofit Insider Podcast. Let me make sure, hang on, do I have anything else? Episode 50 is coming up. Listen, I have a big, big guest for episode 50. I can't even share this guest, but this is going to be a very good one. 50 episodes, so be sure to subscribe so you can listen in on that. All right, listen. Mega guest. One of the things, I'm on LinkedIn all the time. Feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn if you haven't already. I'm on LinkedIn all the time. I had a chance to connect with an old friend of mine, old colleague from way back when I was just a teenager. I am joined today, Meredith Whitaker. Meredith is the Foundation Relations Development Officer for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm a Tar Heel born. I'm a Tar Heel bred. We're going to talk to Meredith today. She has an amazing backdrop, an amazing career in the fundraising nonprofit space. And I'm so excited because, listen, there's a lot of aspects to the nonprofit, but fundraising is one of the big ones. Meredith, good morning, afternoon, evening to you. How are you?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well today. I'm just really excited to be here on the podcast and talk about fundraising and all things money related to nonprofit.
Yeah, it's funny because when you type in, if you've ever had, you know, you looked at podcasts and you type in just nonprofit as an example, a lot of the nonprofit podcasts that exist out there are related to fundraising. And it's for a reason, right? Fundraising is a big piece of the nonprofit space. And I want to dive in, Meredith, to who you are and what you do, but I want to start with where you are in life right now, because you have a great backdrop. You recently started, like I said, as the Foundation Relations Development Officer for UNC and Chapel Hill, only about 4 months ago, if I'm not mistaken, starting a new job. Yeah, starting a new job. It can be exciting, right? It can also have its challenges. How are you feeling? How are you doing in your new role? Give us a breakdown of what a Foundation's Relations Development Officer does.
Sure. Well, it's a good question because at a university, there are all types of fundraisers. And I'm learning that myself because my background is not in higher ed fundraising. My background is in development work, but I am new to the higher ed, you know, world as of just a couple months ago. So my role at UNC Chapel Hill is actually fundraising for two of our programs there at the university that relate to what they call student access. So when you think of, or I think when a lot of folks think of fundraisers at universities, they probably think of those letters that you get in the mail if you're an alumni, and, you know, folks asking you for money. And so those are certain, you know, positions at the university, but there's a lot of other fundraising roles, and mine is a little different. So the work that I do is raising money for one of our programs is called the College Advising Corps, and that's a program, it's tied in with AmeriCorps. So, but we have other funding, partners as well. But that program works actually in high schools across the state to do college advising. So it's really helping students in these high schools learn about access to college, how to, you know, fill out their FAFSA, just learning how all of that works and basically helping those kids get to college. The other program that I work with is a program related to transfer students. So it's helping community college students, again, across the state, get into Chapel Hill, and once they're there, to find success at Chapel Hill. The other interesting thing about my role is that I am really fundraising with foundations only. So I don't really work with individuals.
Okay.
So that's the thing about, you know, like I said, there's just so many different types of fundraising roles, and some of them work with mainly individuals and people that just want to donate. But then there's other roles like mine that really focus on writing grants to foundations.
Give us a little bit behind the scenes when it comes, because you said higher ed. So that's out, that's a term when you're in that space, you're probably using that a little bit more compared to if you are a program manager with Big Brothers and Big Sisters, you might not use maybe that type of language. When it comes to working, like you said, it's even in the name, Foundations Relations Development Officer. I'm always curious to know, like, how many accounts are you messing with? Do you have like 100 different foundations you work with? Do you have like 10? How does that work?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm still so new in my role that I probably can't even give you like an accurate answer to that. But I would say, you know, it really, in the university setting, as I have learned just over my short time, they're all different. You know, some universities are, of course, bigger than others and have a bigger development operation than others. So at UNC Chapel Hill, obviously, like, we're pretty big and we do a lot of fundraising. So there's just tons of foundations that we're working with. But again, it's so varied from role to role. Whereas I am working mostly with these private foundations and foundations in North Carolina specifically, because those are the types of organizations that want to fund the types of programs that I'm working on. Some of my colleagues are working with more national foundations, research focused. UNC Chapel Hill is a big research university. So colleagues are working on grants for research. So it's really varied. But in my role, it's a manageable number of foundations that I'm working with.
Nothing too crazy. Yeah. Well, look, I want to share with our audience here a little bit more about who you are. We jumped right in to kind of get in a sense of your new role and all that stuff. But you have an interesting background. And so I want you to take me into your nonprofit journey, because you and I, we first met when we were camp counselors together. You know, we were both camp counselors, right, at the Autism Society of North Carolina in Black Mountain, North Carolina. Shout out to Black Mountain. And of course, Autism Society of North Carolina, they're 501c3. But you have had a connection to the nonprofit space. I can imagine maybe before you're even a camp counselor, you know, what was one of the earliest interactions you had in the nonprofit space that you can recall? And then take us in the journey of how you end up stepping into the money side of the nonprofit world.
Right. Well, I think probably like a lot of people, my first interaction with nonprofits was more on like the volunteering side of things, and just, you know, hearing about nonprofits growing up in my community, because I just remember like Relay for Life being a big thing in my town, mm-hmm. Brothers Big Sisters, and those kind of things that I had sort of interactions with. But how I actually ended up being in this professionally was also probably like a lot of people find their jobs. I just sort of landed in it, you know. I think it's funny to me how we spend so much time like in college talking about and thinking about like, what do you want to do? What do you want to be? And then as if it can be really scripted, but
right.
It's kind of random, but at least for some folks. So I studied psychology as my undergrad, and that's how I found out about the role at the camp. I think I remember just getting an email about it at where I went to college at App State. And I thought, oh, this sounds interesting, because I thought, you know, studying psychology, maybe I would want to be some kind of a counselor or a therapist or something like that. So I did the camp where I met you and had a really great experience there. And there's kind of by the end of my college experience, just decided, you know, I really love psychology and loved studying it, but didn't really want to go on and pursue a master's in psychology, which is what you have to do to be really a psychologist. But I knew I wanted to just kind of do something meaningful. And so I was just looking for work that was, you know, in the nonprofit space, because I thought that would be the most kind of meaningful work that would feel good. And just landed at a small community foundation. So that was really my first job out of college, was at a community foundation. And Maybe I should define what that is in case people, it's
Yeah, go deep, because we have people that listen to podcasts that, of course, are in the fundraising space, but we always like expanding our knowledge. So yeah, give us a little breakdown. Go ahead.
I'll just explain quickly what a community foundation is. So, if you know, just foundations in general, they're entities that give out money to nonprofit organizations that give out grants. But a community foundation specifically is a specific type of foundation that where the money that they give away comes from individual donors in the community. Versus, if you think about a private foundation, that's an entity where a very wealthy person set it up. Maybe a long time ago, maybe recently, but they set it up and they might have given some parameters around how they want the money to be used after their death. And then the private foundation just endures. The money's invested and the private foundation makes grants from those investments. So with a community foundation, it's not just one donor. It's many, many, many donors, and they're setting up all kinds of funds. And so we had scholarship funds. We have donor advised funds, which I think we'll touch on a little later, and we had grant making funds. So that's kind of what a community foundation is, and I just landed there. That was just, and it was actually a part-time job that I found. So I was only there for about 18 months, but then from there moved on to my full-time role at the Winston-Salem Foundation, which is where I still live here in North Carolina. And I was there at the Winston-Salem Foundation for then 11 years.
You know, that's a perfect transition because I just stepped away from my role with the American Red Cross. I was with the organization for 10 years doing work in the volunteer services space. And I just left that role not that long ago, like in this last month. And yeah, you worked with the Winston-Salem Foundation for 11 years. And you often hear of millennials kind of leaving their jobs like every 2 years, every 3 years. Millennials are were tasked or were stereotyped as bouncing from job to job. You know, to what degree do you believe you grew as a person spending, when you're spending 11 years with one organization, they've seen a lot of aspects to your life, not only career-wise, but personal-wise. What are some of the areas that you grew in your experience being with one organization, one foundation for a decade plus?
Yes, so I do think you're right about that stereotype about millennials, and I felt that when I was there. Was like, wow, I mean, I could tell that I had been there a really long time compared to some of my peers. But you know, thankfully, while I was there, I was able to kind of experience different things because I am curious and I like to learn. And thankfully, at a sort of small organization like that, you have opportunities come up, and I was able to move around. So I did a few different roles while I was there. But yeah, I grew so much because it was my first real experience. Like I said, I worked at another community foundation before that, and then was at Winston-Salem. So really, all I knew was community foundations. But I really got to know them very well. And after I left the Winston-Salem Foundation, I went into another role at a nonprofit where I was only there for 1 year. And so that's a very, you know, stark contrast, being somewhere for so long and kind of, yeah, becoming sort of like an expert in my area, to then going somewhere where I stayed for just a year. But you know, my time at the organization I went to, it was called the Public School Forum of North Carolina. And it was very influential for me, even after only a year there. It was the kind of the first time I was exposed to like fundraising in a more traditional sense. At the community foundation, I did work with donors, and we do a certain type of fundraising, but it's very different from what you would do at a typical nonprofit. So I felt like my time at the Public School Forum was a really influential and kind of turning point in my career too.
Once again, I'm joined with Meredith Whitaker. She is the Foundation Relations Development Officer for the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She spent 11 years at Winston-Salem Foundation, and she is an amazing leader in the nonprofit space. We're talking so many aspects of money today. Glad to have you here on the Nonprofit Insider Podcast. And you know, Meredith, you're someone you went from giving out money, working within the foundational space, to someone who now raises money as a fundraiser, and you're doing it for a college, no less, higher education. Now, I want to get into what it's like working within the college system here in a little bit. I think a lot of people would be very curious to learn some more about that. But first, take our audience into some of the differences between working within a foundation that's focusing on the distribution of money, upwards of $75 million a year, to now you're asking the greater public for money. I mean, those are two different things. How has that career move changed your perspective of foundations, fundraising, just philanthropy in general?
It actually changed my perspective a lot when I made that move. And as I said, moving into my role at the public school forum, I mean, that's where I was before UNC Chapel Hill. That move in particular was really influential to me because I went from, as you said, being on the side of philanthropy in which I was the one distributing the money to these nonprofits, to then being truly a fundraiser and really needing those grants. I quickly realized how insulated I had been in the foundation world. And, you know, that's not true for every person in a foundation, of course. Some folks that I worked with had backgrounds in nonprofits and had been fundraisers before and then came over. But I hadn't, you know, I had only ever worked in the foundation. And so it was a big eye-opening moment for me kind of transitioning over and just realizing, wow, like what a privileged position I had been in being at a foundation and being just on that side of the table and then going into being the one asking for money, writing grant proposals, navigating these relationships with foundations was just, like I said, really eye-opening. And I really saw firsthand the power dynamics at play. Anytime you're talking about money and how it's moved around and where it goes and where it doesn't go, there's just a real power dynamic there that we talk about. I mean, the foundations, at least the sophisticated ones who know what they're doing, they know about it, but until you kind of experience it, it was really a game changer and really made me feel kind of passionate about like what we got to find better ways to work together between these foundations that have the money and these nonprofits that are the grant seekers.
Yeah, if you're a private foundation, it's super funny. I was reading a really good book. It's called The Givers by Dan Callahan. Have you heard of that book by chance?
I have not.
It's a really good book. I might even free promotion. The book, it came out, I think, in 2018. Just because I know I'm going to want to get the exact title right for the folks that are listening here. Once again, join with Meredith Whitaker. Just an amazing person giving us some great insights. We've got a lot of good things to go. Okay, here it is. Yes. The Givers, Wealth, Power, and Philanthropy in a New Gilded Age by David Callahan. He wrote a couple of other books that I really appreciate. And one of the things, and it's so simple, but in the book, he talks about the top private foundations you can think of. Bill and Melinda Gates, the Kellogg Foundation, the Ford Foundation. And one of the things he said is, if you are a nonprofit foundation, you have $500 million, and let's say you invest that money and you get just 10% gains every year. That's a high amount. Let's say every year you get 10%. That's $50 million. With the payout rule that we know that exists from the IRS, you may be giving away $25 million a year, $30 million a year, but you're just gaining more and more money from interest. So a lot of these foundations can last for a very long time. And so, yes, you're going to these foundations asking for money. The power dynamics is definitely real. And I think there's this ivory tower feeling in the nonprofit space that comes with private foundations. I want to get your take well, some of the different aspects of the foundations and nonprofits and ways they can work together when you acknowledge the differences that exist between a charity nonprofit and a private foundation nonprofit.
Right. Well, yeah, I appreciate what you noted there about the investments. And, you know, there's actually, even some debate internally within foundations, in within that world, about should foundations exist in perpetuity. I mean, that's kind of the idea. They do. They're there to exist kind of forever, by investing those resources and then only giving out kind of the earnings, or only giving away a percentage. But that's, you know, just kind of an interesting thought, if you think about it, is that these foundations are built to kind of be around forever, whereas nonprofits are struggling just to, you know, get by and get the money that they need every year, and kind of living on this hamster wheel. And there's just something, it feels a little off. But on the other hand, it's important for foundations to be around, because that's where the money comes from. And we need those returns on the investments in order to get the grants. But yeah, how can, you know, nonprofits and when I say, when I say nonprofits, I'm, like you said, referring to the grant seeking nonprofits. Of course, foundations are also nonprofits. The nonprofit, the word nonprofit just covers so much. It's
Boy, does it.
Yeah. but the nonprofits that are grant seekers, and then the foundations giving away the money, my take on it is that there just needs to be better communication, more transparent communication. And that's hard, as I've noted before. It's hard because of those power differentials. I quickly learned, becoming a grant writer and being on that side of things, that you can't really be honest. You can't really just say, hey, we need general operating support. That's what we need to make it and to do well with the programs that we have. You, instead of saying that, you have to, you know, read their request for proposals, see what programs they are interested in, and then create a proposal that that fits, you know, the foundation's interests. And so that's the work that you're doing. The best way of doing things, but that's the current setup. Now, there are certainly foundations that are on the more that are on the end of, like, being more knowledgeable about best practices. And there is sort of a movement within the world of philanthropy called trust-based philanthropy that, have you heard of that term?
No, actually I haven't heard trust-based philanthropy. I mean, it sounds like a concept I could kind of imagine, but yeah, how would you explain it for the audience?
Yeah. So there's kind of a movement towards this, but it's basically just foundations, or, you know, any institution that has the resources to give away. They're trying to become more, how do I say it? Like aware of these power dynamics that I just mentioned, and they want to give away more general operating support for these nonprofits and do it over multiple years. They want to decrease the amount of time that it takes for nonprofits to apply for grants, and basically just put the trust and some of the power back to the nonprofits rather than with the foundation. So that's a movement. I will say, like, when I was in the world of foundations, I thought that movement was much more prominent than it actually is. I think when you're in any industry, you can get into that kind of echo chamber, and then you get out of it and realize, oh, things are different kind of on the other side. So it's definitely not it hasn't accelerated as much as I thought it would, but it is a thing, and hopefully that will grow. But in terms of how the two can communicate better, I think that there's some really basic things that I learned becoming a grant writer that I thought, why did I never hear about this when I worked at a foundation? And one of them is just the simple act of making it easier for nonprofits to apply for grants. I know I kind of thought that, well, I guess nonprofits would go on to the website and they would write their grant proposal, and it's, you know, simple as that. But actually writing a grant is, you work across your team, you work with multiple folks within your organization to do it. And so a Google Doc is really the best way to do it. I mean, it's a collaborative process, and it takes time and a lot of thought. It's not just writing. It's also brainstorming and editing and creating, like I said, ideas for projects. So, I always just kind of wished, why don't these foundations just give me their questions in a Google Doc? Because what I would have to do is Yeah, I would just be part of my job was just going into these online portals and copying and pasting the questions. So if we have any grant writers listening, I'm sure they can relate to that because there's just a lot of copying and pasting from these grant portals into like a Google Doc or a Word doc that you share with your teammates. So it was just such a simple thing that I thought, you know, that would just make life so much easier if these questions weren't kind of buried in this portal. But as far as other ways to just communicate better, I think, you know, one thing I realized was that foundations could really maybe not focus as much on showing their impact. I go to, you know, a lot of websites for private foundations and just sometimes wonder, like, who is their audience, you know, because really their audience should be the nonprofits that they're supporting. I mean, the purpose of a foundation is to give away money, to be a really good steward of resources and make sure that the money is flowing where it needs to go. That's not simple work. It's complicated sometimes. But it is like the basis of the work. And so really just focusing more on that rather than showing their own impact as a foundation. That was just something that I kind of had my eyes opened to once I got onto the other side, so to speak.
I wanted to take the time to do a quick pause. This is going to be the only commercial break in the entire episode. And when you only have one commercial, that means you need to do me a favor. Look, it's hot. There's a lot going on. Hopefully you're having a good time with the friends, the family, having good cocktails, just chilling by the pool and staying cool. And as you're listening to the Nonprofit Insider Podcast, we know you're 48 episodes in. We need you to do me a favor. Go to Apple, go to Spotify, and leave a review. It's easy and it's one of the best things. You can, of course, you're going to share this with your friends. You're going to like, you're going to subscribe, but leaving a review, that's like music in my ears. That's a gift. If you want to give me a birthday gift, leave a review, go to Apple, go to Spy, leave a review and let the people know how much you enjoy listening to the Nonprofit Insider Podcast. I think that's it for right now. Let's get back to the episode and hear some more from Meredith Whitaker. People take notes to what Meredith is saying. Again, I think your perspective is just so wanted because I know there are a lot of people that are in the, so you almost see like A wants to go to B versus B going to C, where people in the fundraising space, they want to jump over to the private foundations. But the fact that you were in a private foundation and now you're on the other side, I mean, your insights, this is something where a lot of people are definitely thinking, dang, it'd be nice to connect with her. So we might hear at the end of the episode, if you're interested in connecting with Meredith, maybe she'll drop some ways you can connect with her. I get a sense at one point in time, some point in the future, Meredith, I feel like you're going to be consulting.
Oh, that, I am interested in that. I think that would be neat.
Listen, I get a feeling, hopefully I can be a customer or I can like just work beside you at that point when you open the Meredith consulting firm, because wow, you're really dropping some gems here. And one of the big things we had connected over was DAFs. And in a previous episode, in episode 44, four episodes ago, I talk about the rise of donor advised funds. And I want to get into your take of donor advised funds or DAFs, because not everyone is super familiar with them. So can you break down what is a donor advised fund for our audience and why are more and more people using donor advised funds in the nonprofit world?
I feel like donor advised funds are being talked about a lot within this world. And so, yeah, I worked with donor advised funds for a long time being at the Community Foundation. So just a brief like explanation of what they even are. It's basically, you know, you could think about it as a charitable checking account. So people who have money that they want to give away, they want to be charitable, they can set up an account to do that. And so that's really all it is in its most basic like definition. But there's all, they donor advised funds exist in all kinds of places now. They were actually started at community foundations. That's where they got their start almost a century ago. But now they exist in, you know, at Fidelity, Schwab, Vanguard, they all have donor advised fund products now, as well as even like some universities offer a donor advised fund, hospitals, some charities affiliated with other institutions. So donor advised funds are kind of all over the place now. But the ones that I worked with, of course, were at the Community Foundation. So I was really working with just anyone in my community, Winston-Salem, who wanted to set up an account to make their giving easier. That's how we kind of marketed it. If you are someone who gives away, you know, $100, $50 here and there, probably wouldn't be beneficial to you to open a donor advised fund because you are going to be paying a little bit of a fee on it and it might just not be worth it. But if you're someone who's giving away, you know, a significant amount of money per year, then you might find it helpful to have a DAF be for like administrative purposes, because it's a place where you can keep money until you're ready to give it away. And then when you want to pay it out to charity, the foundation or whatever institution you're connected with will cut the check for you and they'll keep the records for you. You can pull, you know, reports on your giving. You can, it's just a way to organize things for folks that need that. So there's a lot of controversy. I think this is why you hear about DAFs a lot. Because of the controversy, which,
of course,
which is warranted, but you know, I think they're talked about as a tool for like hoarding resources. And, you know, that's a thing. I mean, I'm sure some people definitely do use their DAF for that. My experience at the Community Foundation was a little different just because, like I said, we're talking more about your everyday person there. I wasn't working with like the Zuckerbergs or anyone with, you know, extreme wealth like that. But we had some big donor advised funds, just like any community foundation would. But they were just, you know, they were funds for people to give away money to charity. And that's what I worked on, was helping them make their grants from their funds. Now, you know, I also hear a lot about the requirement or that there's no requirement, right, for DAFs to pay out a certain amount. And that is true. There is no requirement. So people can use it. And I think it's like anything. People can take advantage of that, you know, just like they can take advantage of anything. So some people are going to use it for good and some people aren't, probably. But yeah, there's no requirement on when dollars have to be spent. And so I think the concern that is valid is that folks can put a lot of resources into a donor advised fund for a tax break, because that's the other benefit to people. Mm-hmm. Besides administrative support that they get, it's also they're giving to a 501c3 institution, even if they're giving it to Fidelity, right? It's Fidelity's charitable arm. And so they're giving it to a 501c3 technically.
Technically.
And so they get their tax receipt at that time. So yeah, there's some, for me, in my unique experience, having worked at a community foundation, there's a lot of gray area with the DAFs, because I then went, you know, to a nonprofit where, of course, I'm seeking money and resources. And I, you know, quickly learned that in the nonprofit space for fundraisers, DAFs aren't always seen as a positive, right? They're sometimes viewed as like, well, this is money that we don't have access to, and we don't know how to get access to it. So that's a question that I've heard a lot, is like, how do we get access to these dollars in donor advised funds? And it was a really interesting question for me to hear after having worked with the donors of those funds for so long and then moving into nonprofit fundraising, because I always had viewed those accounts as simply just another place that charitable people put their money, right?
Yes.
So you don't get access to them in any other way than you would just get access to any donor, right? It's just, well, you have a relationship with a donor, and if they want to give you a gift, they might give it from their donor advised fund. But I think the concern that comes is that if you have a really wealthy individual and they choose to put those resources into a DAF versus a private foundation, as a fundraiser, you can't find that, like, whereas you can do research on private foundations. And so I can see that as a, you know, potential barrier.
And that's why you're on the show, because I'm reading articles, blogs, and insights, but it's so interesting just to get your take on some different aspects of a DAF that I did not know. So yeah, I think I'm going to be talking about this the rest of 2024, the aspects of donor advised funds and a lot of things that the IRS are really looking into. Are you a fan? Let me just ask you, are you a fan of them?
You know, that's a really good question. I would say I'm not necessarily a fan, but I'm also not anti-DAF. Like I'm in this weird space, Swim. I really am, because I hear all the concerns, but those concerns were kind of a surprise to me, you know, after leaving, just getting out of my foundation bubble and then moving to nonprofit. Like I definitely see the concerns, but I also think, well, again, it's no different from stewarding any of your donors, right? They're just normal people that happen to put their money into a DAF versus their checking account, right? Like they're yes. still going to give you money. It might come from a different place. And so, but I think the one thing that I do see as a, could create a hardship for nonprofits seeking these resources is like I said, there is a possibility that someone would set up a DAF instead of a private foundation. And then a private foundation is required to give away 5% and a DAF isn't. And so, yeah, that's less money going out. And it's less accessible for nonprofits who might be trying to research the foundation. But it's just misleading in some ways. That's one thing I see that's a negative, is that if a nonprofit fundraiser is doing research on, well, what are the largest foundations in my state, or what, you know, which foundations are giving away money? And that's research that nonprofits typically do. They want to know who's giving away money, and then they want to see which grants they're giving away, right? So they can see how they align. It does get very misleading. I mean, and I'll give you an example of just at the foundation that I worked for. They are one of the largest funders in the state in terms of the dollars that are given away. But when you look, if you're looking at a list of just purely dollars, you'll see that the Winston-Salem Foundation, for example, gives away about $75 million a year. But 90% of that is donor advised grants. And so for a nonprofit fundraiser, it would be more helpful in research if you could really just see, well, what are the foundations giving away that are truly foundation driven?
Yes,
because you do your fundraising differently for individuals than you do for foundation grants. You know, for individuals, you're stewarding them differently. You're not filling out an application. You're doing different work. And so it would be helpful to see those numbers divided out. But unfortunately, and the same goes for like just how, you know, you see the dollars given away by Fidelity and the dollars given away by Schwab, and those numbers, I don't know, might skew some reports and things. So I think it does make it difficult in some ways for nonprofits. And I do see those things as a hindrance. And I also, of course, don't like the idea of folks hoarding their money. It just happens that, you know, my experience wasn't really that. Like the people that were giving to donor advised funds where I worked were giving away their money on the whole. I mean, of course, it's some, you know, you have to send reminders sometimes. Sometimes you have to prod folks, but they were just people that just wanted to be charitable. And so they set up this account. And even, you know, people, even community foundations that house donor advised funds, the people that have funds there probably have their money in lots of different places. You know, people with money don't keep it all in one place. And so they might have donor advised funds even at Schwab or something like that, and a community foundation. And we always saw it as, well, if you're going to have a donor advised fund and you want to make sure that it's really beneficial, have it at a community foundation, because if you're putting your money with Schwab or Fidelity, they're just earning a fee on your, you know, of course they're doing some work for you, and so they're taking a fee, but that fee is just going to support a giant, you know, corporation. Whereas if you're paying a fee to your community foundation, that's a small nonprofit in your community that is doing good work in your community. So that was kind of our, and I think this goes for probably any community foundation that does donor advised funds, is that's more of the pitch, is like, yeah, you can, nowadays you can have a DAP anywhere, but here's why you might choose your foundation.
It's funny. I'm here with Meredith Whitaker, Foundation Relations Development Officer, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They're the big ones. A lot of people know Duke and Chapel Hill, of course. So if you know anything about North, even if you know nothing about North Carolina, you've heard of that rivalry. And I want to get you out of here soon. I want to have some, I have some questions about relationships and things like this, but I would be remiss if I didn't at least talk about what you're doing in the higher ed college space. Because a couple episodes ago, I think it was 10 episodes ago, episode 39, I did an episode titled Colleges Have a Donation Problem. And one of the things, this is around the time, we're not going to get too crazy here. We're not going to get too crazy, but this is around the time there was a lot of conversations at Harvard, MIT, University of Pennsylvania as it relates to different aspects of what's happening in the global space. Two of those college leaders left for different aspects of thinking that the different colleges were not being as responsive to different aspects of what's happening in the Israel-Gaza space and things like that. And so colleges are in the midst, they're in the middle of a storm, in my opinion, where not only are you talking about what's happening on college campuses, but there's a lot of blowback from student loans that are happening these days. There are a lot of aspects to groups across the United States saying colleges aren't worth it. Don't go to college. Different people are saying, no, college is still worth it. I mean, colleges are really at the center of like almost like a hurricane. And there are a lot of things that are causing. I know for me, I went to college. I've been very vocal about this on a podcast. I went to college, Warren Wilson College. And when I left, I had a low amount. I had $39,000 in student loans. But I've talked about how I didn't really feel at the college level. There was a lot of information provided to me as an 18-year-old for different aspects of going into college. And you look back now and you go, yeah, it was really nice. It was really worth it. But there's still a lot of saltiness that can come with being in the college space. I'm just curious, Meredith, from your point of view, now that you're kind of in that aspect of higher education, I mean, I don't even know where to start. Colleges raising money. Do they need the money? How does that, seriously, from your point of view,
I get that.
How does that all work?
I get that question. Yes. And as I mentioned at the start, I am new to this. So you might need to ask me again in about 6 months or a year, because I'm trying to absorb everything. A lot of the folks that I work with have been in this higher ed or, you know, university setting for a long time. And so I'm just here like learning all the new lingo and the processes and everything. But maybe that's a good point to speak from, since I am new and I like you kind of had that mentality. Well, of all the nonprofits that need money, a university, right? They've got endowments, they've got lots of resources. And so I'm still learning how it all works, but I would say, you know, there's so many different types of fundraising. And so in my role, I actually am raising money for programs that are not just supporting like the university, they're actually supporting students' access. And so maybe my role is a little different than, you know, I would love to speak with someone that does that kind of alumni giving side of things and see if they've felt that from, because I agree with you, there seems to be a trend or just a mentality out there that, well, I paid a lot of money for college, why would I, you know, give now if I'm still paying off debt. But I think that I have seen in my limited time, I'm sure I could speak more eloquently to this in a year or so, but I have seen a lot of efforts, at least in my little world, to around student access, to educate folks better. I think there's a growing trend of that people are realizing, oh yeah, like maybe 10, 15 years ago, we weren't educating these high school kids about what it really means to take out these loans. That was and is a big problem. I mean, in some cases, you know, kids not even 18 are taking out debt that's going to affect them for a really long time and affect other decisions in their life, you know, like buying a house and having kids or those kind of things. So I'm encouraged to see that maybe the tide is shifting on that, and we are trying to give more education beforehand. So I guess that's all I can say to it at this point. But again, maybe I'll have something more for you later.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, one thing I always got to give, you know, got to give the other side of it, because it's not all college's fault, right? I mean, we know over the span of the last 2 decades, 3 decades, 4 decades, the amount of money that is from the general public in terms of tax revenues and things like that from the government to public foundations or public organizations, public colleges, is going down and down and down. So there are a lot of colleges that are really feeling the pinch of, hey, we used to get, I don't know, 25% of our money from the state of North Carolina, and through various measures, that number is being gutted. So now we're only getting 20 or 15 or 10%. So they're going, hey, we're not getting as much money from our state as we used to. So now we got to go to other means to get some cash. So it's not all on college's fault, but yeah, colleges are an easy target in a lot of respects. And we all kind of look at the colleges through different measures. So a year from now, you got to come on and you got to really drop some more gems.
All my new insights. Yes.
Look, a couple of questions. We're going to get you out of here. Listen, this has been a fun 40, 45 minutes. We're learning a lot here, but I want to make sure to jump right fast into the fundraising side of the table once again, because you often hear in the fundraising space over and over again, relationships are the key to money. The relationships are relationship. You know, you've only been doing this for, like you said, about four months or so. Is that true? Are relationships really that important in the nonprofit space? Or is that just something that is said to mask the fact that nonprofits need money? So we have to say it's relationships. We have to say it's the mission. But is that really true? Is missions or is relationships really that big?
Well, I think that people talk about relationships in the fundraising space because there is this phrase I've heard that people give to people. I don't know if you've heard that or not, but people give to people. And what that means is that, yeah, like we are, when you're fundraising, you kind of are a salesperson. I mean, we don't really like to think of it that way because there's some, like anyone else, I've had salespeople come to my door and it's, you know, it's kind of always an uncomfortable thing. But so we don't really like to, I don't think of ourselves that way, I guess, but it kind of is. I mean, you are selling the mission. You're selling something that's not tangible, which is even harder to sell sometimes because you're really just trying to persuade someone, a person or an organization that your mission is worthy and that you really are making an impact. And it's hard to do. And so this idea of people give to people, it means that people aren't just writing a check or foundations aren't just writing a check to some vague entity or, you know, they're really at the heart of it, like doing it because you are making this face-to-face interaction. You have built this relationship. They trust you. And so, yeah, trust is a big part of it. So I think to your question, like, is it really all about relationships? I think that's just yes, but it's because that's just how our human brains work, is that we're only going to trust someone if we know them and we've built that relationship with them. It's kind of, and when you're giving away your money, it takes a lot of trust to do that.
There's some truth to it. There's some truth to it. There's no doubt. It can't be denied. Look, I want to get you out of here. If people are interested in connecting with you, is there a best way to do it? Do you have like a business email or anything like that? Because I know people are going to be like, oh, I want to be able to talk with her. I want to learn more about her. How can people learn more about you and what you do?
Oh, well, I am flattered. I guess until I start that consulting business one day down the road, I'll just say, connect with me on LinkedIn. I love to connect on LinkedIn. Like you said, that's kind of where we reconnected, but I'm on there a lot. And please always feel free to send me a message. I have really enjoyed just sharing about my journey and would love to answer any questions anyone has.
Yes. And let it be. Listen, don't just jump in her private messages talking about, hey, you know, can I reconnect? Be sure to be like, hey, I listened to you on the podcast and love what you had to say. You know, just don't jump up in there. Let her know. Give her a little context here. And one of the things I want to get you out of here, but I have one more question for you, Meredith, before I let you go. Over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, I talk to people in the nonprofit space, people in the for-profit space, people in government. And whenever I talk to these folks about fundraising, there are a lot of people that say they would never do it. Because it, again, it has a sales component, right? It has a little bit to some people that maybe don't know about the industry or the particular sector. They have a little bit of a negative connotation, right? I'm going to people. Hey, can you, like you said, like alumni groups. Hey, I know you graduated. Can you give us $100? Can you give me some money? It can have that negative connotation to it. But I know there are people that listen to this podcast that are interested in fundraising. So, you know, Meredith, if you're alone, you're in a quiet room. It's just you by yourself. No kids, no husband. It's just you by yourself. You're in a quiet room. And you think about the work that you do in the nonprofit space. How do you see the work that you do? How do you envision it? How do you explain it? How do you break it down when you're in a quiet room by yourself about being in the nonprofit space as a fundraiser, no less?
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One is this quote that I heard a long time ago. And have you ever heard of the organization Charity Water?
Matt Damon, I think, is the guy that's...
Is it? I don't know if he's connected.
I think he's like the celebrity endorser behind it. Maybe. I think he's part of the owner, part of the creators behind Charity Water.
Well, I think I heard this quote from one of the founders of that a long time ago. But he said, I think this, he was re-quoting it from someone, but he said, "Toothpaste is peddled with far more sophistication than the life-saving work of aid groups." And what he meant was that, wow, isn't it a shame that like all of these products that are around us all the time? I mean, for example, like Coke and Pepsi spend $3 to $4 billion a year on their advertising to sell, you know, sugary water to people. Yeah. Like, whereas these nonprofits, whether they are human services related, education, arts and museums and any kind of nonprofit, they are organizations that are doing work that actually, you know, changes lives and saves lives and is necessary and essential to these communities. And so it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of a myth that like nonprofits should shy away from spending too much money, whether on advertising or on staff salaries or whatever, because again, if you look around, like everything that's marketed to us, these companies are spending huge amounts on their marketing to grow their brands, and nonprofits are doing in some cases even more important work. And so that's kind of how I just always remembered that quote, and it just seems as if, yeah, like this is important work. Why wouldn't we, you know, ask people for money for it? And the other thing I'll say about just fundraising and nonprofit work, I guess, in general, is that I have seen a lot since being in this world. I've talked to a lot of people, heard this a lot about passion and following your passion. And although I have not ever worked outside of the nonprofit sector, I imagine maybe that's not as common. Like maybe that's more, it's more of the, as I said, when I started out right from college, I wanted to do something meaningful. And so that's why I got into nonprofit. And I think maybe that's why a lot of people do it. But I have just learned over the years that passion is great and it has its place. And for some people, that is what drives them. And that is what gets them out of bed every day, is the passion for the work that they do. I also want to just share that it's totally okay, whether you're in fundraising or any other position, to do your work because that is your job and they are paying you a salary. Like, I think that that just gets missed sometimes. And you think, oh, well, to get into nonprofit work, I have to be, you know, super passionate about this cause and maybe even like take a pay cut to, because I'm passionate. And I think that just does a disservice in some cases to the sector as a whole. I mean, people in nonprofits are doing, again, as important work as anyone else. It should be respected. It should be well paid. And passion has its place. But I think if we focus too much on that, some of these other things get lost. The fact that people doing nonprofit are not volunteering their time. They're doing essential work that requires, you know, a good salary. And so I think that's just something that I think people should know and remember.
It's a-okay. Yes, I always say anywhere from 10 to 11% of the U.S. population is in the nonprofit space. 8% work in the government space. And then the remaining like 82% of people are in the for-profit space. So there's a lot of aspects to being in the nonprofit sector that can easily be overlooked by the greater public as a whole. So Meredith, you have once again, over the span of this 50 minutes of conversation, given us some great insights. Listen, be sure, because I know we're going to have some folks that are like, gosh, I do want to be in the fundraising space. I'd like to be able to connect with someone. You can connect with Meredith on LinkedIn. She is there. We're going to make sure we drop her name in the show notes so you can have the ability to reach out to her. Meredith, this is good reconnecting. This is the first time we've had a conversation since 2008, maybe 9. When's the last time we really talked?
Since we were like living in cabins up in the mountains.
I'm definitely
swimming 3 times a day, right?
Listen, I listen in a previous episode. I'm dropping so many episodes. I'm trying to look here. It was episode May 15th on my episode 44. I talk about a nonprofit horror story and I talk about swimming 3 times a day. I tagged the Autism Society and the organization listened to the episode and they reached back out to me and said, thank goodness they thought it was going to be like a bad story about the organization. But I just talked about how, well, you remember it'd be like you'd be in the pool that third time in the day and you'd be looking at the camp leaders like hoping you were the first ones out of the pool because it was treacherous.
Absolutely. Getting in and out of a pool 3 times a day. That stuck with me. I know the campers loved it, so it was great for them, but it was a lot.
It was a lot. Well, it's so good to reconnect with you. Final words from you, Meredith, before we get out of here.
I think that's it. I covered so much. Thank you so much for having me. And it was great.
Absolutely. All right. Listen, this has been episode 48 of the Nonprofit Insider Podcast. Again, be sure to follow us on all the platforms. Be sure to subscribe. And listen, do me a favor. This is free. You don't have to pay for this. The only thing I'm asking, leave a review. We love reviews. I think we have 11 reviews on Apple Podcasts. My desire by the end of 2024 is to get to 25. See, I put a big goal out there for myself. To get more reviews. I know we're going to get Meredith to leave a review at some point in time. She's going to give 5 stars. We want you to give 5 stars as well. And we'll see you on the next episode, episode 49. Take care, everyone.